as we did last week, we'll begin chanting the Metta Sutta. So on the handout that I gave you, this is called the Discourse on Loving Kindness. And we've been practicing chanting it in the style done by the monks and nuns of the Western Thai forest tradition. So an arrow beneath the syllable means the tone goes down, and an arrow above the syllable means the tone goes up. I will sing through it, and those that have been learning with me, just join in, and we'll find our way through. This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied, unburdened with duties and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm and wise and skillful, not proud and demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove, wishing in gladness and in safety, may all beings be at ease. Whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be at ease. Let none deceive another, or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another. Even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings, radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded, freed from hatred and ill will, whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness. One should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding. By not holding to fixed views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being freed from all sense desires, is not born again into this world. All right. So as we've talked about the last few weeks, the text begins with an invocation of the path of practice, beginning with the practice of ethics, the skill in goodness. And it begins with these qualities: able and upright, straightforward, gentle in speech, humble, not conceited, content, easily satisfied. And we talked about how these are qualities of renunciation and the vow to live in a way where our actions and our intentions manifest well-being in the world, and the possible conditions for the mind and heart to settle, to open, to clarify. We talked about the relational aspect of ethics and the relationship to our elders. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove. And the way that ethical action is both individual, it's an individual vow, and it held communally, and there is an aspect of a healthy, what we might call shame, in the vow toward not harming, and that healthy shame, in a way, is a mature relationship to one's own past actions. That I see harm that I have caused, whether intentional or unintentional, and I vow, but with a kind of passion, that I be protected from acting in that way in the future, from causing harm, and that this line that the wise would later reprove, you know, that I'm in relationship to my peers, my elders, my community. And of course, this week we're in the middle of the kind of cresting wave of Me Too all over the news and social media, and following this recent, you know, high profile outing of a sexual predator. And in a way that some folks that I know have oriented toward, like, oh, you know, would it be possible to do this without blaming or shaming anyone, you know? And of course it is, if you take the vast and beautiful view that everything that happens, everyone's actions are a product of conditions. And everyone themselves is a product of conditions. And this is the lens that points us toward a systemic analysis rather than an individual fixation. And I think this is important, because if we think it's only individuals causing harm, we might forget to look at our own complicity, our own place in the system, and we might forget how systemic certain ills are. And I wrote this morning a little bit about the reflecting on the Me Too wave, and in really reflecting on how, you know, every woman I know has some relationship to sexual harassment and abuse. And it's so endemic in our culture that it's nearly impossible to think of anyone not having some relationship to it on whatever side. And this means that to focus on individual terrible abusers is necessary, if only to remove them from action. But that it's also appropriate to turn our lens to the whole system and how the loss of a basic ethic of care for each other, respect for each other, is a profound loss for the whole culture, and is a poison, a toxin in the whole culture. And so, you know, to not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove, why is it that, you know, men like this can get away with causing so much harm for so many years and not be taken to task by their peers or their elders? And this is, and this isn't simple at all. My first Buddhist community was a Zen community where the teacher was an old Japanese man. He was 85 when I met him, and I knew him for, you know, the next 20 years. He died at the age of 106. And when I got there, he was already notorious for sexual harassment of women students, some men, but all the women, and it was one of these terrible community situations where, like, everyone knew, and actually most weren't even in denial And over the years, there had been several interventions. All the monks would get together. They would say, what can we do? They would write him a letter. They would like gather in council. They would direct energy toward it. They would demand that he stop and do things differently. And it would just die down for a little while and then just return. And this happened several times. And it's very hard to fire Zen masters, you know. It was a classic kind of pyramid system, you know. All the people challenging him were his students. And we only found out after he died that the reason he came to the United States in the first place may have been that he was kicked out of his home monastery for misbehavior with money and sex. So, strange sort of cultural collision, right? A badly misbehaving monk whose teachers had reproved him was kind of sent away so as not to cause further harm in Japan and ended up being one of the most respected teachers here. None of us could speak the language to figure out what his past was. He did a lot of good here and he caused a lot of harm. And he was confronted about it over and over. And so I don't even want to be idealistic about, like, you know, oh yeah, if we only had an intact structure of peers and elders, this wouldn't happen. But really to think about how systems perpetuate harm, and then everyone born into those systems has a relationship to it in some way. So the end of the first part of this text, it ends with this invocation of ethics and these qualities of the skillful, wise being, and then the wish, may all beings be at ease, in gladness and in safety. Safety being core to well-being. That it's impossible for the nervous system to heal and restore a sense of well-being if it doesn't feel safe, at least for moments. At least the feeling of danger, it has to subside for practice to be able to deepen. And so that's a whole process unto itself that means community, that means safe spaces, that means protection, it means legality, it means boundaries. And then the text swings into, from this basis in ethics and care for one's own actions and the qualities of renunciation and kindness to bring into our practice, then it swings into what should we do with this wish, may all beings be at ease. And it really shifts, swings into a definition of this phrase, all beings. So the next line is, whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short, or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be at ease. So the orientation is toward living beings. And then these dyads, these pairs, weak or strong, the great or the mighty, medium, short, or small, seen and unseen. There's, when we begin this practice, it's the heart practice is particularly metta, compassion, kindness. It's the formal practice has us begin with sending kindness to those we really respect or love easily. You know, your dog, the great saints, Dr. King, Dalai Lama, whoever is in your famous saints category. One of my students just did several months of practice just with David Bowie as her, you know, the target of her loving kindness. And it worked. Her heart was like, oh, you know, blessed David. She put a picture of him on her altar. And then she just hooked into the practice of honoring the dead rockers. She now has Greg Allman there and Tom Petty, and she's of a certain age and genre, such that the folks who are dying are kind of her heartbeats now. So, so the practice begins with love folks that are easy to love, and then the process of developing this boundlessness of heart means extending that feeling to folks who we don't know, where there's not that intimate personal connection, and then even to folks who are difficult for us, and then to everyone everywhere. And this is this is at the heart of so many religions and philosophies and profound systems, but it's this is a particular flavor of it. The Baptist church across the street from my house has one of those, you know, kind of marquee things, and the pastor puts these messages up, and sometimes they're funny, and you know. So this week's message is, God said, love thy neighbor, period. He wrote out the word period, period. And I liked it very much. I often like what they put up. And the metta instruction to cultivate the feeling of loving kindness or compassion or joy, and then radiate it to everyone, no matter who, is that same instruction, but it's phrased in a way that really orients the mind toward the vast and kind of non-specific. Love your neighbor is a good instruction because it stays in a certain way specific. It's like, oh, those exact people I disagree with that live next to me, you know, or that are like right here in my town, you know. Oh dear, the Nazis are coming to town. And then I look at the marquee, the Baptist church, and oh no, they're my neighbors. You know. And then you really have to practice the like, okay, I will love my neighbor and I will strongly criticize their actions, you know. And it's like you two are divine, stop what you're doing. And practicing holding both at the same time is hard, but that's the instruction, love thy neighbor, period, the marquee says. Here, the instruction enfolds that one. It's part of the metta sequence. Start with sending love and kindness to the people you really like, your teachers and your family and your friends, and then to people you don't even know. And the formal practice on retreat is like, think of someone where you can think of their face, but you don't know anything else about them. Somebody you see, often we say like, you know, someone who checks out your groceries at the grocery store, or the post woman or man who brings the letters by. Whoever, someone neutral, and then someone you really don't like, and it's particularly in the neutral and the difficult person categories that this kind of love thy neighbor period teaching comes in. But the heart of the metta practice is not actually in the specific healing that comes when we learn to love a neutral person or a difficult person, that we have to do that so that no one's excluded from the field, the universal field of kindness. But the feeling that the texts suggest cultivating and really, really letting fill your being is this kind of omitting none feeling. So that really the everybody feeling, whatever living beings, including those that haven't even been born yet, those born and to be born. So the list is nice. You could add things to this list, you know, but it's nice particularly that, you know, we can read it as pinging some of the kind of standard ways that our heart might get stuck, you know, whether they are weak or strong. You know, maybe I have a strong kind of social justice orientation and I really love the downtrodden and the oppressed, the weak, in quotation marks. And I really hate the powerful and the oppressors. Or I flip that and I say, oh, those powerful men, they're so weak at heart, but I love the strong, oppressed poor who live in community. And, you know, like, it's easy to orient toward the qualities we like and send a lot of love to those folks and then exclude the other folks. Whether they are weak or strong, omitting none. I totally want to omit people from my practice of loving kindness. And, or it's not even that I want to. I actually don't want to, but I just do. I can't help it. You know. Like, I'm scrolling through my feed and, you know, and there's one story that says, you know, what did I see today? Heroic dog stayed behind to save the sheep that he loved. They all survived. And I'm just like, the dog saved the sheep. Like, instantly, I love them, right? And, you know, and then it's like, you know, oh, the Swedes are considering making neo-Nazism illegal in Sweden. I'm like, ah, the Swedes, I like them, you know. And so it's like, oh, that one's not quite accurate. I got the news story wrong. It's something like that. It was in Germany, Sweden, Nazis in Europe. But anyway, good folks resisting, right? And again, it's like, oh, I like them. Oh, the Nazis, I don't like them. And, but then I remember this practice and in a sense my vow to try even to omit none. Omit none. And in a way it really throws me back on my heels. It's like, oh, wait. I actually can't continue to operate in my usual kind of dividing the world into categories thing if I want to do this. I can't just go through my feed and be like, good people over there, bad people over there, terrible things happening, but there's a few heroes, but there's some really nasty ones. And sort of my mind just kind of separating things out into the stuff I like and stuff I don't like. And even sort of scrolling through and reading all these different sort of Me Too and hashtag I am complicit and all the different variations on this meme of let's wake up to power and patriarchy in relation to sexual harassment and abuse. And even some part of me is like, oh, I like that response, but I don't like that response quite as much. Or that one could be a little more, like I'm just judging all the time. And if I actually take this seriously, you know, omitting none means that I have to change my relationship in some way with that part of my mind that's judging everything all the time. That's judging, this is the good stuff, that's the bad stuff. I have to do something with that. And so the great or the mighty, like, oh, I have to love them too. The medium, the short, or the small, I kind of like that one, like the short. Short beings, love them, you know. The seen and the unseen is mysterious, right? Maybe it means like spirit beings, maybe it means in an interesting way, just like the beings I don't know. Subtly, the beings who may be even like in this room with me, but I don't really see them. The seen and the unseen, the ones who I pass by on the street, I don't really see them. Judgment operates in this unconscious way. Right? So it's like, it's not like I'm even thinking, let me go around the world and divide everything into the I like it and I don't like it box. That all of that happens before I even become aware of what's happening. Very often, the only thing I become aware of is stuff that fits in certain boxes. I'm aware of the stuff I hate, and I'm aware of the stuff I really like, and there's a whole bunch in between that's kind of neutralish that I don't even notice, and there's stuff that I'm afraid of that I don't even notice, and there's stuff that I take for granted that I don't even notice. So then part of this practice, of course, as we talk about a lot, is waking up to those parts that I don't even notice. Wake up to the people that are neutral, that like you wouldn't even think of them. I went through a whole period where I tried to do this practice really formally. And I was like, okay, I'm going to walk down the street, and I'm not going to let my attention glom onto any particular person, either the ones that I really like or the ones that I really don't like. I'm going to try to let my attention stay soft, but notice everybody. every last person, every person doing their thing, I'm just going to kind of inwardly know that they're there. And what that meant really was becoming aware of the way that my attention is always kind of fixating and excluding, fixating and excluding. If I take on the practice of noticing everyone, I will have to lose the practice of fixating on some. Because you can't do both, in a way. When I'm fixated on one experience, it doesn't have to be just people, but any kind of experience, I don't even notice what else is there. I go to my favorite restaurant, I don't even read the menu anymore. I just order one thing. And it's like, oh, everyone's like, read the whole menu. You're like, oh, wow. I never, didn't even notice that was there. So you can do this with anything, right? But people is poignant. The seen and the unseen. Those living near and far away, of course. Those born and to be born. Is this teaching that comes in through the channel of the North American indigenous traditions, the seven generations into the future teaching, that our actions should be considered in the way that they affect seven generations down the road. It's a couple hundred years, more or less. Ever since the early 70s, when Joanna Macy started doing her work with nuclear waste, she brought in and really worked with addressing or coming out of denial of the reality that we've created this substance that will remain harmful for tens of thousands of years. So, you know, seven generations, 70 generations, 700 generations will be affected by this stuff. And of course now, climate change. So those born and to be born, may all beings be at ease. Thinking of future births brings in this idea that's at the heart of the Buddhist liberation project that we talked about a handful of weeks ago, kind of looking at what it could even mean, the idea of rebirth, future births. One way of thinking about this can be that we can recognize that our actions have immediate results, they have near-term future results, and they have really infinitely long results. Studying history is an incredible way to think about this. You know, in the news story about the Swedes and Germans, it was flipping back and forth. So I'm now mixed up about who I'm talking about, but Northern Europeans kind of resisting a rise in neo-Nazism, and they quoted one of the kind of neo-Nazi leaders there saying, you know, we're just trying to preserve our you know, Christian heritage. Use the word Christian. And it got me just, and I thought, because I go historical quickly, which is a way of sheltering me from feeling the full blow of the immediate present. But it also feels useful in some ways. I thought about, like, oh, the Christian heritage, like, what is that really? And I was like, oh, you know, like, what if, you know, what if Emperor, I'm going to get this wrong, Constantine didn't, like, convert to Christianity, decide that the whole Roman Empire was going to be Christian, do a whole thing, and then suddenly, boom, Christian Europe. And now, you know, we've got this neo-Nazi, you know, marching down the street of Stockholm, being like, I'm trying to defend my Christian heritage. And to be like, wow, what an action that had such a long rebirth, such a long trajectory into history. I read some kind of scholarly reflections on, like, there were tons of, like, itinerant street preachers in the Middle East around, you know, the turn of a couple millennia ago. Why was Jesus the one that, like, kind of changed the world? There were lots of them. And it's the same with the Buddha. There were all these different teachers around the time of the Buddha. They all had Dhamma. They all had doctrines. They all had followers. Lots of them could do miracles. And the sense of why the Buddhist teachings persisted, the sense from within the religion, is it's not just that the Buddha was the most right of them, and we can sort of just say that that's an opinion held by only people who believe that, so you can kind of bracket it off. Who knows if he was the most right? But the early system did some things that made it last, and there were conditions that helped it last. And so what a long lifetime it's had. In the same way, we could think about, like, some of our actions have only a very short-term, you know, consequence. And others, you know, last far beyond us. I thought about this when I was about to, thinking about having a child. And I was like, oh, if I don't have a child, then, like, a lot of what I do kind of, it almost like it evaporates out into the world like energy or like steam. But the particular kind of, unless I do something really big and public or somehow something, you know, really, really hurt somebody or really do something wonderful, it kind of ends with me. But if I have a child, the image I had, this is funny, this is how I think, this is my image of having a child, was like, oh, this is the old billiard ball image, I'm a billiard ball rolling down a hill. There's gazillions of other billiard balls around. We're all bumping into each other. It's chaotic. And then I bump into other billiard balls all the time, and that energy passes out in all directions. That's one bit of me going out. But I could also break off a little part of myself, make another little billiard ball along with somebody else helping a lot. And together we take that billiard ball, and we just, like, with the best throw we have, we just, like, chuck it into the future, and it goes crashing out there, and then we die, God willing, first. Or whatever happens, it just goes on without us. And maybe it does the same thing with somebody else, and it makes more believer. And it just kind of, I was like, oh, maybe that's what rebirth is. It's like I do this action that just, like, way outlives me. And so those born and to be born point to how our actions have such a tremendous effect. And they have a tremendous effect way out into the future. All of the beings, human and otherwise, who are yet to be born, will be affected by our actions. Therefore, what is there to do other than to just be as clear and wise and strong and loving as we can, to radiate this kindness and compassion, that it means so much more than just us and our particular drama, what we're doing. Like, what you're doing, it's about your story, but it's about so much more than your story. This vast story is unfolding around you. Practice of radiating this kindness in all directions, and including those that are difficult for us, but also just including everyone. It does something to the heart. Even to just shift love out of strictly the personal frame, which is its most common frame, or the judgment frame of, like, I like this collection of people, to everyone. Something happens in that shift, and I'm trying to come up for a word for it. I don't have a word. it's almost like, as I try to do it, it's like I think of someone I love, and then I just take that feeling and I open it to everything. All I get is this kind of feeling, like it kind of blows open. But in the blowing open, it also becomes a little more like, it becomes simultaneously sort of stronger, but kind of, but more diffuse. And that feeling then is something that in the meditative practice you would concentrate on, is the diffuse but more and more powerful feeling of just like omitting no part of the universe from your own energy, from the radiation of your own energy of kindness, and just shining it in all directions. And to do that, you have to disappear a little bit. Because if you are this sort of like, you know, individual center point, I don't know, it kind of just doesn't work in the same way. Like, you have to also become a little diffuse in order for that thing to be vast enough. Maybe it's that if I hold my individualness, I can't help but love certain people more, certain beings more, because I'm holding the separateness quality. In order to really go all directions equally, omitting none, I also have to do the omitting none practice with myself. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah. If you wanna hold everything, you have to disappear. If you want to hold a certain things very strongly, you will become more solid. Yeah? So if you take on a specific cause or a specific group as your thing, that part of you that identifies that specific thing will also become stronger in relation to it. You become more of an individual when you pick a single thing because your energy focuses. And that's valuable, right, when a specific thing needs attention. But the meditation of it that really unbinds the heart from fixation takes that energy and blows it open. What do you think? Open into just hearing from some of y'all about this, but particularly that maybe this thing about like individual versus everyone, the non-omitting part. Any of that? How is that? Yeah.
This is beautiful. The concept that we could relate to ourselves as part of the whole.
Yeah.
And organic with the connections that we have in our mundane life in a way that is not grasping. It's not me.
Yeah.
It's about just going along with the stream and feeling that journey, let it be good or bad.
Yeah.
Because the judgment is a survival instinct, which is the cause of a lot of pain.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. I'm glad that you're saying it. The judgment is a survival instinct. And that means that when our survival is being threatened, that judgment is appropriate. Right? Like, it's appropriate when there's immediate, as they say, clear and present danger to assemble the forces in relation to that. And then the challenge is to let them soften again when that danger has shifted back into, you know, the field of safety or community again. And that's hard to do. It's hard to do.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Other thoughts? Yeah.
So one of the ways when I'm trying to working on this practice and trying to include people that are more difficult to send loving kindness to, is that I can think that, you know, if they felt all of this loving kindness, that they would be different.
Indeed.
But maybe that's not truly, or is it truly? I mean, sometimes I feel like I'm getting caught maybe intellectually, but it's like, well, is that really loving them as they are? If really what I'm trying to love them into changing.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's true, right? If they were feeling, if people who are doing a lot of harm were to change such that they were feeling lots of loving kindness, then they wouldn't do so much harm, and that would be great. So, and I think wishing that be their experience is a wonderful thing. right? It's not that different from my, you know, from my seeing someone I care for and being like, I care for you, but you get so caught by this one thing, you know, and I really wish for you that you wouldn't get caught by that. In the same way, I could say, oh, I don't care for you so much, but I see that you get really caught by this one thing, and I could wish for you that you not get caught by it. And it could be the same quality. I think both of those can exist without necessarily, like, you falling into the trap that doing your practice equals, you know, wishing that they were, equals trying to make them change. It's even different to wish that someone else change than to try to make them change. And you use the phrase like loving them just as they are, and or something like that. And it makes me think about in the metta practice. This really hinges on the like the self not self aspect of this. But nothing in the text actually says, you know, loving difficult beings just as they are. It says love everyone, essentially, no matter their qualities, great or small, medium, whatever, seen and the unseen. But when we say loving someone just as they are, there's some sense in that phrase in our culture that I think we usually apply it to, like, people we actually do love that have some fault, you know. Like, you know, I love you, but you watch this really annoying TV show, but I just love you as you are because I love you, and I just tolerate that you watch an annoying TV show, whatever, right? That's how I often hear that phrase. But I wonder if the practice, because it's based in wise view and the wish for beings not to harm, if it actually includes loving or accepting those aspects of beings that are harmful or unskillful. I want to say something like, it's actually fine to wish that unskillful beings become more skillful. I think it's great, actually, to wish that people who are causing harm not cause harm. I have to recognize that I can't make them do that. Like, all I can do is, like, broadcast teachings out into the world and do my best. But I'm open to the mystery of, like, intending to shine kindness and compassion toward folks. And still wish that they grow up, especially if they're causing harm. I'm not trying to accept everyone just as they are, actually. And maybe I'll grow into doing so, but at the moment as I practice, I still find myself wanting to cultivate this quality of a vast impersonal love, and maintain a kind of discernment and really a kind of critical fire toward wrongdoing that feels appropriate to me. So that's what I know about that. It's a really good question. I never quite said exactly like that, so I'm glad you asked it. What do you think?
It resonates. It resonates, too. I mean, I was thinking along the lines of people who are doing harm. Mm-hmm. And it resonates the idea of acceptance of someone who's trying to see.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And also sort of resonates with many of the different practices that we do, where we sort of have an intention of sending big seemingly impossible wishes out into the world to create balance.
Yeah.
It seems to be a pattern. So that as you were talking, I was sort of seeing it in that context more as well.
Yeah. Yeah, Zen has a great way of saying this. At the end of all the chanting ceremonies we would do, so twice a day in the puja, we would chant what are known as the four great vows of Zen that say, beings are numberless, I vow to save them all. The defilements are endless, I vow to uproot them all. You know, and it's just like, you know, the Dharma way is unfathomable. I vow to understand it. And you know, and at the end of a long, and the system knows that they're impossible and vast. And that's the whole point. The whole chanting ceremony is done at a certain speed. Like, a little faster than the heartbeat. It's sort of pages and pages and pages of Sino-Japanese syllables, and you get into this whole kind of trance. And then the four great vows are done at like micro speed, and they're just like four times. And at the end they just hit the big bell and it's just like bong. And you know, it's a whole sort of psychodrama, you know, beautiful performance of like, now we're going to vow to do something totally impossible. And the only way to do it, of course, is that you can't do it. The only way to do it is to forget the self. Right? If you are a singular, individual, limited being, there's no way you can save beings, all beings. If you have your singular, limited, individual set of passions and defilements, there's no way that you can upload? uproot. explode the set of all defilements. The only way to do it, the Diamond Sutra says this clearly, it says, the bodhisattva vows to save all beings. But the bodhisattva who thinks that there is such a thing as beings to be saved is not a bodhisattva. In other words, the only way you can radiate to everything is if you let go of the singularity at the center. The only way to save all beings is to let go of yourself being one, a separate one. As soon as you do that, and of course the secret marvelous paradox at the heart of it is that as soon as you let go of yourself being a separate being, all beings are saved. Because you being separate was the same thing as other beings being separate. As soon as you are not perceiving other beings as separate, the whole thing dissolves. And even to say that the whole thing dissolves for you is to revert back into the safety of thinking that enlightenment happens to one being. Whoa. Yeah. Seriously. I can't even actually think through that line of logic, which is logical, and I've thought through it thousands of times, but my mind, every single time I even say it, my mind goes, whoa. Right? Because it the snake eats its own tail, right? The teaching eats itself at that spot. So I think that's where omitting none is actually going. And we're gonna get there at the last paragraph, but we're not there yet. Take a few weeks to get there. Other thoughts on this? Yes.
I really loved what you said about that thing about diffusing the self, you know, in terms of not having preferences with other people. And one thing that I don't know if maybe you said when you were commenting about should we accept people as they are, even when they're doing bad things. To me, wishing them loving kindness is wishing that they not do harmful things, because I think it's at some point when they realize they've done it, they've hurt themselves. They realize that they've hurt themselves, and I don't really believe that somebody can be deeply happy when they're harming people.
Yeah.
And the other thing I just wanted to say is I realized that this omitting none, for me, I just feel kind of unsafe around people who are judging people, because I just never know when I'm going to be part of, you know, that, the target of that judging. And so it just always makes me uneasy. And so I have just a really hard time around. I mean, I judge people all the time, and I'm probably doing it right now, but just the idea of, but just the idea of judgment, I feel as though I need safety when I'm around it.
For sure. For sure. That's the appropriate response in a way. Judgment has aspects of judgment have violence at their core. Right? Judgment divides.
Yeah.
The other part of it has a wise discernment at its core. So even to be able to notice, this is harm doing and this is help, that's a judging, it's a discerning. This is a wholesome action, this is an unwholesome. This is something worth doing, this is something worth avoiding. That's also a judgment.
Yeah.
That's the type of judgment that I like the translation discernment.
Yeah.
That is absolutely the core of the path, right? You have to discern what's to be done and what is not to be done.
Right.
And
right.
The flip side of that, or the metastasis of that that causes so much trouble, is when that gets poisoned by views or ideologies in the heart into, you know, that which is good and that which is bad in a kind of judging others sort of way.
Right. Right.
Or ourselves.
If you're discerning about actions and behavior, it can have an understanding that there's a blindness in the unwise action and harmful action, and have a compassion for that blindness and ignorance. And that, to me, that's part of, you know, more safety. But it's that blade that can go quickly into judging and hatred and violence that just makes me really, really uneasy.
That blade is sharp.
And it's slippery.
And slippery. Sure enough, it is.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah. Yeah. Anyone else? Yeah, and we have a couple minutes. This could also just be like, how are you doing? What a fucking week it's been, right? Any way that part of what's been unfolding and just in our world has, you know, has affected you, has been up for you. Yeah, Sarah.
At times is overwhelming. How do I actually feel, like, it's even if it's a loving kindness towards their loss, it's still feeling the loss in a way that I'm like, I just don't know how to hold all that, or how to disperse all that, or how to be, like, I want to be with the recognition of their grief and to be present to that, what is going on.
Yeah.
And also to, like, hold my center.
Yeah.
And just wondered, like, how to balance the compassion with, like, center and calm.
Yeah. It's huge. It's a huge practice. How to balance compassion. And compassion, as you're describing it, like, really almost like a string of personal encounters, like, oh, this person and their exact loss, and then, you know, and then I hear from someone else and it's this person and their exact loss, and then I, you know, I look at the news and it's these 5,000 people and their exact loss, and then I hear from another friend and it's this person. And so, at least from the perspective of the, you know, the formal practice, it seems like, it feels like there is something about the impersonal quality, like resting in this kind of vast but impersonal compassion, that is not exhausting in the same way as like a string of personal intimate connections. But we all have personal intimate connections also, right? So it's not even, I don't think the instruction is, oh, just rest in the vast impersonal. We want to care for each other distinctly and intimately. I think a little bit about how does each particular contact, you know, like, what if we were just talking and you were saying, like, oh, my, you know, this person I know lost their home and I'm really feeling it, and I might feel that, oh, I'm so sorry, that's terrible, and I feel the ache of that. What's that like for me anyway? Like, does it instantly overwhelm my system where I kind of fog out a little bit? Or do I kind of get really warm and like come closer to that person and everything focuses in? I want to start kind of sensing like what happens in my state when I come into contact with someone's pain. And the thing that maybe we practice toward is that is a kind of being able to really connect, you know, intimately and directly with what someone's experiencing. And then in a way be able to give that person what would help them or feel with them what would be helpful, and then to let my system kind of come back. So like maybe I talk with someone and it's intense, and before I go on to doing the next thing, I just, you know, turn off the phone. I mean, I'll totally do this. I'll have an intense conversation with someone, and I can't just, like, jump back into work and be like, okay, you know, good luck with that. Okay, back to emails. Like, I have to just, like, I kind of walk aimlessly around the house a little bit, and I look out the window, and if it's really been intense, I can feel that my body's kind of vibrating with it, and my heart is beating, or I feel a kind of density in my somewhere. And I have to just hang out for a little bit, being with that, and noticing like, oh, I'm really affected by what just happened, by that communication. And when it works well is when I have a little bit of space to come back to myself, to orient to where I am. So it'd be like, oh, that was really intense. But here I am in the red room with the Buddha. And, you know, I let my attention rest, like, oh, and look, the candles are here, and all these nice people are here, and my state shifts as I bring it into contact with the present and here and me. So, yeah, so part of it is like, and of course this is always what we have to do. Like, this life is overwhelming sometimes. So I think there's a lot of practice in, like, how do we not get overwhelmed? You know, and build in, like, space between things. When Hatha Yoga first showed up in the States in the early 70s, a lot of the most common styles, like the Shivananda style, the integral style, still do this. Shavasana between every pose. Mm-hmm. Take a pose, rest. It kind of let all the energy settle back down to neutral, and then take a new pose, and then rest. And now we're like, no, amplification. Take a pose, and another pose, and another pose, and another pose, and another pose, and let it build, and build, and build, and build, and build. And then finally, rest. But with things that are already intense, I think there is a wisdom into, like, ride a little arc with somebody, and then, you know, say thank you, and go out to the snack table and have some snacks and look out the window. Mm-hmm. Make sense? Mm-hmm. Yeah. I wish my life was more spacious than it is a lot of the time. And for me, that's the thing that makes it hardest, is that I feel like I have to just go from one thing to the next thing. Yeah. Cool. Thanks for being here. I love that we have this, and I love that I get to chat with y'all and hear your questions and sing together. Really, thank you for coming, being here. And so, as always, we're on the profound and systemic resistance practice of gift economy. Being here is free in a certain way, which means that we have the opportunity to offer what we bring in a way that supports the space in an impersonal way to be here. So your gifts of your resources really help the studio and myself to come and offer this so that everyone can come. So thank you for your generosity. Cash in the box. On the pretty box in the thing, there's a mailing list next to it. If you're not on my mailing list and you want to be, other kinds of payment can happen at the front desk. And sign up for the subtle movement class if you're interested in that aspect of practice. I would really love to have a lot of folks from this group there and continue some of these types of teaching in the physical container of that practice, which is so lovely. So, blessings to you and your families and your friends and everyone in harm's way. May all beings be safe. Thanks so much. See you soon.